We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to Untangle. I'm Patricia Karpus. Today's encore guest is Dr. Marissa Franco, a New York Times bestselling author, professor, psychologist, and self-proclaimed friendship expert. She discusses the science of connection and the importance of platonic friendships. Her book is called Platonic: How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. She believes friendship is the single best action a person can take to live a longer life, take the edge off depression, flourish, and even revitalize a marriage. She challenges the notion that friendship should be at the bottom of the relationship totem pole. She gives us many reasons to prioritize platonic love and bring more friends into our lives, nurture the ones we already have, and keep building community. If we do these things, she says, we'll always be surrounded by love, whether or not we choose a romantic relationship. Untangle is the podcast from Muse, the brain-sensing headband designed to help you unlock your brain's full potential, and Meditation Studio, the 5-star app. Check out the hundreds of free meditations available at choosemuse.com/meditationstudio. Now, here's Dr. Marissa Franco. Marissa, welcome to Untangle. So happy to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and congratulations that your book made it to the New York Times bestseller list. That's super exciting.
It really is.
It is. And it just, I think it speaks to how important some of the concepts that you're communicating are. So let's start with, what was your inspiration for the book? And feel free to go back as far as you would like to with your childhood or how this happened more currently, whichever you prefer. But I'm really curious about your inspiration for this.
So I will say I came at writing this book on how to make and keep friends, not as someone who was like really amazing at making and keeping friends. I wasn't bad. I wasn't great. I would say there's a lot of things I did wrong that I talk about in the book. But as someone who is very passionate about friendship, given that in my early 20s, I went through breakups, I felt so bad. I started this wellness group with my friends to heal from the grief. So every week we met up and we cooked, we did yoga together, we meditated. It was so life-changing for me. And it wasn't because of the wellness. It was because I was in community with people I love that loved me every week. So it started to make me really critical of some assumptions that I had that were really contributing to my grief, which was romantic love is the only love that makes me lovable. Without that, I have no love in my life at all. And I looked around and I felt like I have all this love around me. It's always been around me. Why doesn't this count? So I felt like this is a larger cultural problem. And I really wanted to help change our culture, given that we're so disconnected, so that we could value this relationship that's always been right in front of us.
Yeah, I agree that culturally, environmentally, familial
Lee, you have parents that are emphasizing marriage and relationship. And if you decide to wait a little bit longer than what is the norm for different generations, people wonder what's wrong with you. That's a big part of why people value a relationship more than friendship often. The ideal would be to have either an equal value to them, but never to forget your friendships is really what you're saying.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Does it backfire that for those of us that are putting more emphasis on a relationship than friendships? It sounds like it didn't backfire for you. You just really found value in your community. Does it for some people backfire?
Yeah. And I would say it did backfire for me in that it compounded and amplified grief, and it made me discount just the love that I had in my life already. And I would say this belief that this is the only form of love and we need one person to complete us, one person to be our soulmate. It harms us whether we're single, because loneliness is the subjective sense that you don't have the connection that you really want. And as a single person, that can trickle into how you perceive your life, where you, even if you do have the connection that really fulfills you through friendship, you might start to feel lonely because you've been told that if you don't have romantic love, you don't have true connection. And it really harms people in romantic relationships as well, because there's a lot of research that finds that to have a healthy marriage, you need friends outside the marriage. There's studies that find that when you're in conflict with your spouse, it disrupts your stress hormone release, unless you have quality connection outside the marriage. That if I make a friend, not only am I less depressed, my spouse is actually less depressed too. And for those couples that only focus on each other, when the relationship ebbs and flows, they're devastated in that ebb. Whereas people that have connection outside of the marriage, they're more resilient to tribulations in their marriage because they have this outside relationship to center them, so they can come back to their marriage from a more secure place.
Yeah. And in a way, you're redefining love. And it's just reminding me of Sharon Salzberg's book, Real Love, which isn't about romantic love. It's about love across all different types. And that is a super interesting piece of this, is to look at love as multifaceted. We do talk about loneliness as an epidemic. There's so many reasons for this, but do you think it's in part because of our prioritization of romantic relationships over friendships?
I absolutely do, because if you look at in the Western world in the early 1800s, what friendship looked like, it resembled more what romantic love looks like now. Friends held hands, friends shared beds, friends wrote love letters to each other. So there was this deep intimacy people found in their friends. Men cuddled. Frederick Douglass said his friends are what trembled his decision to leave the plantation more than anything else.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was really deep. Then what happened was these two psychiatrists, Sigmund Freud, Richard von Krafft-Ebing, they changed the way people looked at sexuality. Before them, it was taboo to have sex with someone of the same sex. But it wasn't taboo to engage in these behaviors like holding hands, cuddling, sharing love letters, because none of that is actually sex. So it's not taboo. But they argued that if you want to have sex with someone of the same sex, it marks an entire identity that's disordered within you. So they created this concept of sexual orientation, interestingly. And after they did, people started to double think, oh, maybe I shouldn't hug my friends or cuddle with my friend, right? Because then I might be stigmatized, then my sexual orientation could be stigmatized. So what happened since then is that our friendships have really narrowed the script, and particularly for men. Men really feel like they can't express basic intimacy with other men often because it might affect how people perceive their sexuality. So there's this really caught stuck place where in one hand, we all want connection. But in the other hand, some of the things that create deep connection, we feel like are suddenly inappropriate for friendship, where that has not been true throughout history.
Do you think this is more true with men than it is for women?
I do. There's this concept in the research called homo hysteria, which is men's fear of being perceived as gay, which really limits their ability to engage in closeness with other men.
Yeah, hopefully that's changing, but we probably have a long way to go. And men in particular might put platonic love at the low end of the totem pole, although there is this whole other guy pal dynamic. Did you look at that at all? Like guys, not to be gender stereotyping, but guys doing some things together that seem appropriate to them, like golf and watching sports and drinking beer. I don't know. Maybe that's too gender stereotype.
Yeah, we know that there's complex differences here and some men don't have these trends. But yeah, the trends are that there's this Atlantic article that talks about men needing a third object in their friendships. They need that golf. They need that game to watch. They need that video game to play, which then prevents them from being too vulnerable with each other because they're focusing on some third thing. And what we find in the research is that men are half as likely to be vulnerable in a given week than women are with their friends, that men are half as likely to express affection with their friends compared to women. And they are a lot more likely to, when they find their spouse, to drop their friends. And I didn't understand what that was until I understood that for men, the concept of friend is very different than the concept of it for a woman. And this is, again, just broad trends. That for women, a lot of the things they do with their friends overlap with what they do with their spouse, right? I'm going to be vulnerable with you, right? I'm going to tell you how much I love you. Whereas for men, there's not as much overlap. Their friends are different, very different from what they do with their spouse. So women might be like, well, why would you drop your friends? Keep your friendships alive. But I guess what we have to understand is that for them, dropping their friends means something different. They might be dropping this like casual friend that they see once in a while and they engage in activities with, but not that they feel like they can be truly vulnerable with or go truly deep with. So it's less of a sacrifice for, again, for these men that tend to fulfill the trends in how men make friends. It's less of a sacrifice for them because their script for friendship is so limited. And again, I think this is further informed by homo hysteria.
Fascinating. You start the book with a chapter called Looking Back and examining, if you will, how we've become the friends we are and the connection to our attachment styles that are developed at an early age. Can you discuss different attachment styles and how this inspires our desire and or ability to make friends? I'm curious about these three different styles and how we adopt them.
What I argue in the book is that how we've connected affects who we are. Our personality is a reflection of our previous experiences of connection or lack thereof. Whether you are friendly, open, warm, trusting, cynical, aggressive, these are all personality traits that are influenced by your previous experiences of connection or disconnection. And that's what attachment theory also states, that if you've had these loving, trusting relationships in the past, that affects your personalities in ways that allow you to facilitate continued connection in the future. But if you've had difficult relationships in the past, starting with your parents, there's also a genetic component, but also evolving from there, that affects your personality in ways that make it difficult for you to continue to form connections in your life, because fundamentally your personality becomes a bunch of strategies to protect yourself from the harm that you experienced previously. The issue is you're going into a new environment where these strategies may actually no longer be adaptive, but actually undermine you in your quest for connecting with people. So to go into the specifics of the three attachment styles, the people that have had healthy, close, comfortable relationships, they're what's called securely attached. So they assume that people are trustworthy, they can be vulnerable with them, they can depend on them, they're comfortable with intimacy, they're good at working through conflict, they tend to initiate more friendships, they dissolve friendships less. Like, they're what I like to call the super friends. Because their previous relationships have been so healthy, they have this unconscious template that really helps them prosper in friendships, that other people can be trusted, that they can get close to them, that they're worthy. But then the two insecure attachments, anxiously attached people in the past have experienced some abandonment or inconsistency from people in their life. So they go into new relationships with the assumption that people are going to reject them. The issue is they tend to see rejection when it's not there. They tend to take things really personally. They tend to reject people back who are acting normal towards them, but they look for the rejection inherent in that. And then they become cold. They become withdrawn. They tend to reject other people. They try to reject other people first when they haven't even necessarily been rejected. So they tend to form close relationships, yes, they're good at vulnerability, but they also overshare as a way to test people to see if they'll stick around. Here's all this information about me. Let's see if you'll stick around if I share it. And they tend to be attracted to relationships with people that pull away from them, because that's what they've learned that love is, right? That if you love someone and get close to them, they'll pull away. So they think that when someone pulls away, that's part of the process of love. Whereas secure people are like, you're pulling away from me. Goodbye. I'm going to find someone who wants to be my friend. And then lastly, you have avoidantly attached people. Their past has shown them that people can't be trusted. People will betray them. If they are vulnerable, they will get hurt. They tend to grow up in these families that provided for them financially, provided for food, but were emotionally neglectful. Their parents didn't tolerate their emotions, told them to keep it to themselves, stop crying. And so these avoidantly attached people, they don't really invest in friendship. They report enjoying it less. They tend to be more focused on work. They are uncomfortable when other people are vulnerable, are very uncomfortable when they're vulnerable. They're very out of touch with their own feelings. So they might suddenly feel an urge to pull away and they don't know why. Very uncomfortable with conflict. So they tend to just ghost on you. And so those are the three attachment styles, our strategies to protect ourselves against some of the hazards of connection that also, unfortunately, can harm us too.
How do we know, and I suppose it's based on what you just said and what's in your book, but might we have all of these different styles at different times in our lives? Might we move from one, from avoidant to secure based on therapy or certain practices? How do we know which attachment style we have?
Yeah, Patricia, that's a great question. And a point I want to underline, because I think sometimes when people hear my explanation of attachment styles, they're like, good for those people with healthy relationship paths, good for them. And I want to share that anyone can become secure. And most people in some studies change their attachment style over time. And my book is about all the research on how we can become more securely attached in our friendship. So for me, learning about attachment theory as someone who was previously more anxiously attached, it feels empowering, because if you don't understand your attachment style, you assume that the problem is just the world. No one can be trusted. People just abandon you. And then you don't have any power. You're powerless if the world is just the problem. But if you understand how you can influence people and your relationships, you will be able to have more agency in them. And so that's what I hope the message is. But that's all to say, yes, different relationships can trigger different attachment styles. If someone's avoidant, where they're not reciprocating, they're not engaging with you, they're not affirming you, they're not vulnerable with you, it's natural to feel anxious. So if you meet someone who is very avoidant, you're going to feel anxious, and vice versa. This anxious person clinging close to you, demanding so much out of you, you're going to want to pull away a little bit and re-experience your own agency outside of that relationship. So it's also a dynamic where other people can pull out different parts of our attachment. It can change over time. As we get older, we tend to get more secure. But there's also what's called the global attachment style, which is like the attachment style we tend to show more often in our relationships. And sometimes it can be different in friendship and romance too.
I would imagine, but you'll tell me if I'm wrong about this, that if you're in an avoidant or anxious style, but you're with somebody, let's even say in a romantic relationship that's secure, it's possible that you could become more secure.
Absolutely. Amira Levine, he has this book attached. It's on attachment style and romance. And that's his big suggestion. If you want to be secure, find someone else who's secure.
Yeah. And I'm sure that's true with friends as well.
Absolutely. Yes.
I love that you say the deep connections that we make as friends make our souls grow. What were you thinking when you said that?
So it's this theory called self-expansion theory, which is the idea that we're always looking to expand our sense of self, to broaden our horizons, have new experiences. And the primary way that we do that is through our relationships. So our friends really expose us to different ways of being in the world. And through doing that, we figure out who we are. Our friends are like kaleidoscopes of advertisements for all the different identities we can have. We experience that, we feel that pang of recognition, and that's how we develop a very rich sense of who we are. But not only that, when I say how we've connected affects who we are, then who we are affects how we connect, right? And that people that have healthy relationships develop this healthy template that then makes them better in their future relationships. The research does find that people that had better friendships when they're young, they're more empathic, they have higher self-esteem. Part of the reason is that when we're feeling connected in these healthy ways, we release this hormone called oxytocin. Oxytocin then makes us a better friend. It makes us more generous. It makes us kinder. It makes us more trusting. So fundamentally, our friendships turn us into better friends.
I can vouch for that personally. As you're speaking, I'm thinking about my inner circle of friends and how they have really inspired me to deeper connections and to more vulnerability. And I think it is. That's how we do expand.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. We talk about these often on Untangle. When we keep things bottled up inside, it can start to impact our health mentally, emotionally, and physically. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, whatever it is. If this sounds like you, and it's a bit of all of us, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule and needs. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now over to Untangle.
As humans, your second part of the book is about the practices we can do to make and keep friends, because as you say, it's not based on luck or serendipity. Is this mostly advice for people who are anxious or avoidant? And does making and keeping friends become natural after a while?
These are good questions. I guess in a way, yes, because secure people are pretty good at friends already. But I would argue that all of us have something to learn, because I don't think anyone's 100% secure. But I think the second piece of it is platonic is about becoming more secure, but it's also about really expanding how we view friendships. Like I talk about, a lot of us view friendships as good company. I enjoy your company and I like you as a person. But to me, friends aren't just good company. Like a good friend is, yes, I enjoy you as a person, but we're also committed and invested in each other. I show up in your times of need. I root for you to succeed. I'm generous with you. I'm trying to make your life a little lighter. That's what I want to convey, that friendship is a commitment and an investment, just like what you need to do to create a healthy romantic partnership. You need to do that for a friendship, because I think a lot of us see friendship as inferior and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because then we don't try. We're not reaching out. We're not being vulnerable. We're not sharing affection. We're not doing anything thoughtful. And then it's inferior, not because friendship is inherently inferior, but any relationship you treat that way is not going to become as deep. So that's what I say, isn't it, for everyone, just a culture change. I want us to all see friendship as more sacred, because I really think that it is.
And you have a section on turning strangers into friends. And I was thinking about that because I've always thought about my friendships as like, there's tier one, which is friends who feel like family. There's tier two, which is that next level. And tier three, which are friends who might be neighbors that you haven't gotten into deep relationships with, but they're lovely and might bring you soup when you're sick. What's the value that you place on different levels of friendships and your thoughts on turning strangers into friends? And why do we do that? And when do we do that?
So there's an argument to be made either way, in that having a larger quantity of friends, even if they're not particularly close, benefits our mental health. Having more quality friends benefits our mental health even more, but both provide benefits to our mental health and well-being. And the truth is too, that this question tends to change over time as we age. So people in their 20s, that's when we have our widest friendship networks. And that's because we're looking to expand our identities the most. So we're interested in being friends with really different types of people, because that helps us figure out who we are at this critical time of figuring out who we are. But as we get older, older folks actually tend to prune their friendships and only keep those friends in their life that they feel really close to. And they're actually happier in their friendships. But that's because as you get older, you start thinking, how much time do I have left and who do I really want to spend it with? So it's going to evolve over time, the question of what types of friends make sense to keep in your life. And it is a reflection on what your priorities are at any given point in your lifetime.
Will you say a little bit more about whether it's harder and how much harder is it to make friends in middle age and beyond after you've finished being on your sports teams and in college and going to work every day? And especially now where so many people are working from home, how is all of this different?
When people start to retire, the research finds that the people that are happiest in their retirement tend to replace the social network that they lost from stopping to work. I think older folks, first of all, they actually benefit from friendship even more than younger folks. Hanging out with their friends improves their mental health even more. So it's still very, very important. There's this way that I think older age can almost be a second adolescence for friendship, in that kids move out of the house, people have more time and become more interested in friendship once again, which I think is really beautiful. I think some of the hindrances that I hear of is people feel like it's too late, everyone else have their friends, when, hey, most of us are lonely. Most of us do not have our friends. That is a huge misconception. I think the other thing that people in older age face is that friends start to die and pass away. And there's this very real sense that if I make new friends, they're not going to mean as much to me as this person, which makes people feel less motivated to engage in friendship. But I will say, in general, some of the same tips apply. This was actually a study on older folks that found that when older folks saw friendship as happening based on luck, they were lonelier 5 years later. When they saw it as something that happened based on effort, they were less lonely 5 years later because they showed up to that place of worship. They showed up to the group that they really liked, the travel group, whatever it may be. So at any age, we need to make sure that we're not just waiting for friendship to happen organically. As adults, it does not happen organically. Like, for the most part, as children, yes, because we had school, we had repeated unplanned interaction and shared vulnerability, which is what facilitates organic interaction, according to sociologist Rebecca Adams. So yes, in general, we all need to make an effort and initiate and not just wait for friendship to slip into our lives. I think in the book, the metaphor I use is like fruit flies, find the fruits wherever they are.
How much of it, as you get into middle age, is about changing your expectations? Because some of the friends that you may have had your whole life, you're used to have deep connection. They know you intimately. They've been through ups and downs with you. And when you meet new people, they're seeing you for who you are today. They're seeing you in this stage of your life. And it might be that it's more about doing things together than the deep, intimate relationships that grow as you grow up.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is about expectations. It's about, let me not try to have the same standards for these new people that I'm meeting as the people that have known me for 30 years. There's this interesting concept in the friendship research or interaction research. It's called the mere exposure effect. And it describes our unconscious tendency to like people as they become more familiar to us and for them to like us. So what does this research mean? That our brain is actually wired, when we first meet someone, to be more weary and to be more mistrusting and to be more uncomfortable because familiarity has not set in. Familiarity is a symbol of safety to our brain. And so what I want to tell people based on this research is that if it feels uncomfortable and awkward at first, that is not a sign that friendship is not a possibility. That is part of the process of turning someone into a friend. Like, expect that awkward initial period and stick through it. Stay with that group that you joined to meet people for like 2 to 3 months. And then after that, evaluate whether you're making friends and forming connections.
Do you think there are different barriers to making friends for introverts versus extroverts?
Yeah, I would say there's different strengths. First of all, I think sometimes we conflate introversion with like social anxiety, social awkwardness, when that is not what introversion is. I think I define introversion as you simply get more energy from being alone, so you might require more alone time. But each group tends to have their strengths. Introverts tend to be good listeners, and good listeners make for good friends because fundamentally, people are looking for friends that make them feel like they matter. So that's great. Introverts do that. extroverts, they might bring a lot of energy. They might be more comfortable in like bigger groups. They don't get as overstimulated by a lot of social interaction. They might be comfortable in those bigger groups or those concerts or like joining a meetup group, whereas introverts might be more comfortable reconnecting with an old friend or joining that book club. I just think we need to lean into our strengths. And I don't think either group is superior or inferior. I think that each group has a particular set of skills when it comes to making friends. So asking yourself, what are my skills? What do I bring to the table when it comes to making friends? It's really important because that gives you a sense of confidence when you go out and interact.
Yeah. And I like what you're saying about leaning into your skills and strengths and knowing your own unique self. And that dovetails into your chapter on authenticity. How does one become truly authentic if they aren't already? I mean, what does this take inside of a friendship?
Yeah, so authenticity was so hard for me to define because all these scholars defined it as your true self. And I'm like, what is your true self? So I dig deeper and I find people really report feeling most authentic when they feel most safe. So to me, authenticity is who you are when you feel safe, when you are not hijacked by these defense mechanisms. Now, what is a defense mechanism? To me, a defense mechanism is something to protect you against a feeling that you do not want to feel. So let's say I'm interacting with a friend. Her daughter got into Brown. My kid didn't get into any Ivy League schools. I'm jealous. To protect myself against that feeling of jealousy, I put her down and I say, Brown is okay, but it's not Harvard. And yeah, that's a defense mechanism against me being able to acknowledge, oh, I actually feel inferior or I feel jealous. The authentic behavior is to understand the feeling underneath that defense mechanism, because these defense mechanisms really tend to harm our relationships. They are there to protect ourselves at the cost of our relationships. So being authentic is about almost being vulnerable, choosing the vulnerable feeling that's under the defense instead of going into the being pompous or trying to be better than people or trying to manipulate people so you don't feel that uncomfortable feeling that's really there.
Yeah. Are there practices that can help people with this? We talk on this podcast a lot about different contemplative practices and mindfulness and meditation, and it's important what you're saying about feeling safe and trusting the other person. But you also have to know when you're in alignment with your feelings and your values.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think mindfulness is related to more authenticity because it allows for space between the, I want to go into a defense mechanism, but I will choose not to in this moment.
That all important pause.
Exactly. So one of the big things that I tell people when it comes to making and keeping friends is to assume people like you. That be your starting assumption. Obviously, if you get data otherwise, adjust your initial expectation, but making your initial expectation, assuming people like you. And I think that really creates a sense of safety that allows for our authenticity. According to the research on something called the acceptance prophecy, when people are told that based on your personality profile, you're going to go into this group, you're going to be liked by them, and that's a complete lie, people actually become warmer and friendlier and more open, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Since we're social creatures, to me, who we are when we feel safe is super social and super good at making friends. It's only the fact that we feel unsafe that makes us not great at making friends. Like, I think about the damage that people that feel like no one loves them can do, because that licenses you to be aggressive, to be hostile, to then reject other people. These people that like even commit acts of violence, usually they have that belief that nobody really loves them and nobody really cares. So finding that sense of safety is starting with the assumption that people are going to accept you, assuming people like you, because that's going to bring out the naturally social, naturally good at making friends spirit that I would say is within every single one of us.
I love that. You also talk about the benefits of generosity in terms of giving to others without expecting anything in return. And I just want you to share with us, is this really possible? Is there ever a silent debt? Like, you've done so much for me because I needed this, that, or the other thing, or you helped me move, and then I'm going to do something for you. I always feel like I want to make the score even. Is that something other people do as well?
It also depends on the stage at which your relationship is. Earlier on, we do expect that tit for tat. As the relationship gets closer and more intimate, the assumption is that we're both invested in each other. So fundamentally, our generosity is going to equal out over time. It's the sense that we're both trying to show up for each other. I do this thing now. Maybe some parts of the friendship I'm going to be giving more. Maybe some chapter of the friendship you're going to be giving more. When you get close to someone, you begin to include them in your sense of yourself. So the research finds that, like, when a friend gets hurt, the same part of our brain that's triggered when we get hurt is triggered. So what that means is that we actually experience reward for being generous when someone is closer to us, which is why being friends actually really facilitates this generous act. And it is inherently rewarding. So I guess you could say it's not completely altruistic because it's rewarding for us too.
We say kind things about our friends or even family at a memorial service, for example. And one of your suggestions is that we tell people the things that are meaningful to us while they're here. And this is this idea of really giving affection. Some people are more comfortable with this than others, but I just want to run through the short list and have you potentially add to it. But you're suggesting we tell them how much they mean to us, how happy we are that we're friends, that we're excited for their good news, and we compliment them when they've accomplished something or they look healthy or whatever it might be. We greet them warmly. We remind them how grateful we are to know them, and we support them in reaching their dreams.
So beautiful.
I know. These are your words.
Yes.
It's so important to integrate these ideas into our lives so that it's so natural for us.
Absolutely. Yes. And there was a study that this was on romantic relationships, but I think it still applies that whether someone shows up for us in our joy when we've accomplished something, whether they're amplifying that and happy for us, it actually matters more for how satisfied we are in the relationship than whether they show up when we're sad. So it's so important. And we don't often recognize, yes, like being neutral towards a friend is not loving. It's an intentional act to be loving and to be accepting towards another person.
Yeah, I love that you're saying show up for our joy. In the Buddhist tradition, there's a concept called sympathetic joy, which is the same idea that we share in others' joy. This book is just really chock full of so much. Are there any big concepts that you'd like to share that we haven't covered?
There's a lot of things that I put in the book that are related to our negativity bias, which is our tendency when we predict how we're coming off socially to inaccurately predict and to be more cynical than the truth. So there's research on something called the liking gap that finds that when we interact with strangers and we think about how much they like us, we underestimate how much they like us. So people are less likely to reject us than we think. When I do speaking engagements on connection and belonging, I ask people, like, what are the ways that you would want to share with a friend affection that you haven't told them yet? And people say beautiful things like, I love hearing you smile through the phone. It makes my day. Like, you've made me who I am. And they haven't shared this yet. So it's bittersweet. And other negativity bias is that when we express affection, we think it comes off as more awkward than it does, and we underestimate how positively people perceive it. When we're vulnerable, we think people judge us more than they actually do. It's called the beautiful mess effect. So in so many ways, people are actually safer than your brain is telling you and are more loving towards you than you might feel in any given moment.
This is such interesting material. And again, I'm so excited for you that the book made it to the bestseller list, which really just underscores how important this is. It's such a big part of our lives. And I hope people will really take this to heart. But thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Patricia.
Thanks for joining us today. You can find out more about Marissa at drmarissafranco.com. And her book is available at all major booksellers. And don't forget to check out Muse at choosemuse.com. As always, if you have feedback or suggestions, reach out to us at untangle@choosemuse.com. We'd love to hear from you. Have a great week, and we will see you next time.